Good evening, everyone. Hi, thanks for waiting. We are getting a little delayed start, but we're just, you know, waiting for Layla to come, so we're so happy she's here. No, just kidding. We were really waiting. We're just happy she's here. I'm Deborah and Margolis, and I think I know almost everybody here, so welcome. I'm the librarian that works with the Muslim Studies program, and, you know, we've been doing the Muslim Journeys program for a good, this is our fourth year, and this year we're focusing on racism, war, and genocide as experienced by Muslims or in Muslim societies. You know, I think we were influenced by the war in Syria, the genocide in Myanmar, and, you know, it's all, and, you know, rising intolerance in our society led us to want to, you know, do something and read and talk to each other. So here we are. Thank you to Muhammad Khalil and Layla Tarakji for helping plan this series. And thank you to, well, kind of everyone here, but Fasten from the Islamic Society, and also thank you to the Interfaith Clergy Association and others who have helped from Muslim Studies, from the library. So thank you so much. So here's the format of the program for tonight and all of our programs. So we're going to begin with a short lecture, maybe about a half hour, from Dr. Solano. And then we are going to have one group for discussion based on the number of people here. So we're going to have, we're going to kind of move to just the one, one big table is going to magically appear from our friends. And Asif Iqbal from the Department of English is going to be our leader for the discussion group, and we have questions that we will discuss together. And then we'll sort of, well, we're all going to be at that table, so we'll probably wrap up right there. And so thanks to each of you for coming, for reading, and, you know, for making a commitment to learning from each other here. And you know, whatever your background, your age, your level of education, you all have something to contribute to the discussion. And so just wanted to say that. Thank you again to the graduate students who are helping with this program, Asif and Brian Van Wyk, who's here today and will lead our, some groups in the future. Also, thanks Jessica Ackberger, one of our African Studies librarians, who's helping and knitting at the moment, but she's helping me and can help you if you need anything. So now it's my privilege to introduce Kara Solano. She's the chair of the MSU Department of English. She came to MSU in 2016 from the University of North Carolina. Her PhD is from Duquesne University, and she has received Fulbright Awards to Austria and Belarus. Which really intrigues me, because her scholarship is in post-colonial and South Asian literature, and Pakistani literature in particular. She has a brand new book, at least brand new to our library. It's like in process right now. It'll be on the in the faculty book collection very soon. It's called Contemporary Pakistani Fiction in English, Idea, Nation, and State. And she's also written a book called National Identities in Pakistan, the 1971 War in Contemporary Pakistani Fiction. So obviously we have the right person, and we're so excited to hear from her and learn from her to discuss A Golden Age by Tamima Anam.
Great, thank you. Okay. Let me get this off first so that it doesn't, don't shut down on us. Okay, thank you very much for coming. I wanna thank Deborah and Layla for approaching me months ago to ask me about this, because I've been looking forward to it ever since that first conversation. And I also wanna thank Mary and Mohammed for just all the great things that you guys do with the Muslim Studies program. And Mary, I swear, I want you to come to English because you are so on top of everything that my life would be a lot easier. No. it would be really great. Right, if ever you're thinking about it. Before I get going, you'll find very quickly that I fall down rabbit holes because I get really excited about things. So before I get going, I just want to say if there's something, if there's a moment at which either I've said something too fast, you want me to repeat something, you have something you want to contribute or a question you want to ask, just throw up your hand. Okay, I know this is sort of the lecture part of the format, but I like things to be a little bit more informal, and it can be more discussion oriented if you'd like. part of me could do you know, several hours just in the three maps that I've pulled up here. These three maps, and you can only see this first one so far, really very much tell you the kind of story, the contextual story that I think is very important for deeply appreciating what Anam has attempted with A Golden Age. I will get to these images, but right now I just want them to kind of be on your radar. How many of you guys have seen The Crown? Is that Netflix? Is it Netflix who does The Crown? And if you've seen the first episode of the first season, it's when Elizabeth and Philip are getting married, right? So they got married, it was November 1947. I want to say it was November 20th. Anybody really that much of an Anglophile that they know for sure the day they got married? I think it was November 20th, 1947. That's really important that it was late in the fall of 1947. Philip, when it became clear that Philip was going to marry Elizabeth, and if you've watched The Crown, you might know this, when it became clear that he was going to marry her, he had to become a British citizen, right? And so he had to take a British last name. So he took his maternal grandparents' last name, which was Mountbatten. Okay, oh, Mountbatten. Okay, so now let's go to South Asia and think about 1947. The first part of that year, February 1947, in fact, was when Louis Mountbatten was named the last viceroy of colonial India in February 1947. He was Philip's uncle, okay? Mountbatten, the viceroy, his charge when he was appointed the viceroy by the queen, or not at that point, she was not queen yet, was she? Early 1947, when he was appointed viceroy, his charge was oversee the withdrawal of the British from colonial India. And his timeline was to make sure this happened by the summer of 1948. Okay, so Wikipedia will have you believe that Mountbatten decided to accelerate the timeline for British withdrawal from South Asia because of the communal tensions that were already sparking in early 1947. So Wikipedia would say, okay, Mountbatten decided that the British would leave by August of 1947 instead of a year later in 1948. Other people, however, will say, no, you know what? He really wanted all of the heavy lifting of the British withdrawal from colonial India to happen so that he could go back to England to go to the wedding. He does come back to India, an independent India, and serves as its first governor general for about a year. But, you know, so there's competing stories. You know, so I kind of like this sort of coincidence of pop culture and history. And what I appreciate about The Crown, I haven't really watched it, it hasn't caught my imagination, but for someone trained in post-colonialism, this is one of the ways that we see sort of Raj nostalgia and the kind of erasure of the ways that the empire actually bolstered what we take as ideal English or British life. Right, there is no story in The Crown about what was going on in South Asia, thanks to Philip's uncle. Right, it just kind of goes on its way of, oh, and then they had a wedding. So I wanted to start with that, to kind of start getting you thinking, okay, 1947, the British withdrawal from India. In the summer of 1947 then, when Mountbatten decided that this was all gonna happen faster than was originally anticipated, we know it was both a historic and a traumatic summer in South Asia. Historic because it was the end of the proper colonial era. I mean, we can debate what we mean when we say post-colonial, but it was the end of proper colonial rule, British over the South Asian subcontinent. It was also traumatic, and there are still questions and debates going on about just how many people died when Radcliffe decided to draw lines, and I can show you those lines, the Radcliffe lines. When he started drawing these lines through the Punjab in the northwest and through Bengal in the northeast. Radcliffe was the British cartographer, right? He drew these lines. There's a question about how many millions of people were killed when communities, so Hindus and Sikhs coming from these areas into India, and Muslims going in this area, especially into what became Western or West Pakistan. A conservative number is 1 million, okay? But you know, scholars still debate this, that it could have been significantly more. There was also, of course, millions and millions of people displaced as these large populations moved across these new national boundaries. All of this happens, yes, in 1947. There's lots of studies, lots of historical studies on the long partition, how many years, how many decades it took, especially for Pakistan, because it didn't have all the infrastructure that India had, how many decades it took for them to get over the partition, if they've ever gotten over the partition. But the stuff that happened in 1947 just didn't kind of spring up out of nowhere in 1947. It too had a long history, a history that actually starts in the late 19th century when the All India Congress Party gets founded, okay? I want to talk a little bit about a couple of highlights is really the wrong word, some points in the decades from the late 19th century up through 1947 that I think are really important to know when you have a better understanding of these decades. You see something in addition going on in Anand's novel, okay? So for example, here are some of the points that I want to point out. So as I say, the All India Congress Party gets founded in the late 19th century. In the 1920s, Muhammad Ali Jinnah founds the All India Muslim League. At first, the Muslim League was not quite as influential. I'll just use that word, not quite as influential as the Congress Party, not quite as powerful in the sort of decolonization movement and conversations with the British. And so for the next two decades, from the 20s to the 40s, Jinnah and the League worked really hard, among a lot of other smaller parties, to get a seat at that table and to be the voice of India's Muslims, okay? Her name, Aisha Jalal, she's a historian at Boston University, or is it college? Is it BU or BC? It's B something, okay? Or it could be, no, it's BC or BU. She wrote a book called The Sole Spokesman. I want to say it was the mid to late 1980s. And her book, The Sole Spokesman, was on this man, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. And it really changed the way that people thought about the power of the Muslim League and the reasons why Jinnah behaved in the ways that he did, the deals that he struck, and the decisions that he made as the leader of the Muslim League. So if you're at all interested, her book, I mean, I'm not saying she's right, though I think she probably largely is right, but her book really changed the whole historiographical account of the Muslim League's negotiations with the Congress Party and the British during the 1920s, the 1930s, and the 1940s. So the Sole Spokesman, Jalal, J-A-L-A-L, would be a good place to start. Okay, so the Muslim League really starts taking shape in the 1920s. Jinnah's working really hard to get a place at the table, to be more powerful and more influential, not powerful in a like powerful, you know, Dr. Evil kind of way, I don't mean that, but to have that kind of influence and to be the sort of representative for South Asia's for India's Muslims, okay? In the 1930s, and now I'll go back to this particular map so that you can appreciate this, there was a young student, a young Indian Muslim, Ramat Ali, who was studying in England. He was a Muslim nationalist, and he coined the term Pakistan. And since you're here, do you want to tell everybody what Ramat Ali, I mean, what the acronym part of Pakistan was supposed to stand for?
It stands for the different regions.
Yeah.
Punjab and the NWFP and the different regions, but it did not include Bengal and...
Yeah. Yeah.
Wasn't it the same pamphlet, Now or Never?
Yes, yes. Are we to live or perish forever? He liked his hyperbole. Right. So exactly, he coins this phrase, and the first few letters of it actually corresponded with the Muslim majority territories in the northwest part of the South Asian subcontinent. Okay, so it's really significant and kind of like prescient in a way that it did not look over here to the eastern part, which was also a Muslim majority area. It did not include a B for Bengal. Okay, so already, and I mean, it's just sort of an interesting thing to look back, hindsight, to say already Bengal was outside of this concept. And then, of course, Pak means pure. So it's also the land of the pure, which, you know, starts inviting these Islamic connotations to a region that is not including Bengal. Okay, so that's another point. So it's in the 1930s that this concept of Pakistan, and it's not yet its own independent nation state as a concept. It's really a concept that has both that Islamic purity idea and a sort of territorial idea, these Muslim majority areas in the northwest of the South Asian subcontinent. I want to emphasize there was no idea in the no credible idea in the 1930s that there would be an independent nation. Okay, there was this concept that, you know, at this point they were maybe thinking some kind of federation of states more than they were thinking two separate countries. Okay, through the 1930s, the late 1930s and the 1940s, the Muslim League, even though it has some setbacks, especially in the elections of 1937, it has some setbacks, it does establish itself as really the party that the Congress needs to deal with and that the British need to deal with, right? So they are effective in creating sort of a triangulated relationship as they start conceptualizing how the British will eventually leave the South Asian subcontinent. Yeah, so the Congress Party, so Nehru and Gandhi. Okay, so if Nehru was sort of the political genius behind the All India Congress Party, Gandhi was sort of the spiritual leader, the sort of charismatic icon or leader of the Congress Party. And that's actually a really great segue to a point that I wanted to make. Now, I'm saying this as a scholar, not as somebody who's taking a side in anything, okay? The League, effectively, at least for the audiences it wanted to hit, the League effectively used some rhetoric to say that the Congress Party was in fact a Hindu party and that it wasn't a secular party. You know, and they pointed to some of the things that Gandhi was doing to say, yeah, the Congress may be telling you that if the British leave, we'll have a secular India, but no, in fact, actually it's a Hindu party. And so this works in I don't want to say initiating, because I think the British had a hand in this long ago, but in perpetuating a tension between Hindus and Muslims. Okay, it contributed to that. And it also feeds into this story that I want to introduce via Jinnah's notion of the two-nation theory. It feeds into this story that an independent, undivided India would actually be a Hindu hegemony, right? And this is something that South Asia's Muslims could not stand. They were vulnerable. They were vulnerable socially. I'm not saying this is fact. I'm saying this is League. This is the League's view. Okay, that they were vulnerable socially. They were vulnerable culturally. Vulnerable economically and politically, because they were a minority. They were the largest minority in South Asia, but they were the minority, okay? So even if independent India was a democracy, a secular democracy, which the League did not believe in the secularism aspect of it, but even if it were, they would end up being outvoted, right? So Jinnah has this idea of the two-nation theory. And when he says that, he is still not saying we need two independent countries, right? When he says two nation, you remember in the novel, late in the novel, when Maya and Sylvie have a conversation. Sylvie has gotten religion, right, in a big way that makes everybody like, wow, she's really changed. And this is after basically everything is sorted out and Bangladesh has its freedom. Sylvie says, I cannot support it because it splits the ummah. U-M-M-A-H, that word, ummah. It's the community of believers, right? The Islamic community of believers. That's what Jinnah means when he says the two-nation theory. There is the community of believers of Muslims, and that there are Hindus as a not as an ummah, but as a their own, right? And they have their own economic ideas, their own political and social and cultural ideas. And in that way, they need to be separate. And you know, whether it's reserved seats, elections, all of those things, these things need to be separate. Something happened in 1946. The cabinet mission plan, I won't go into the details there, but that's really the point, most historians agree, in 1946, it's really the point that it becomes clear that there's gonna be two separate nations. So 1946, that late. And as I've already said, Mountbatten shows up in February 1947 with the charge of, okay, we're getting out, you figure it out. And so that late in the game, 1946, it's hitting home for people that in fact there's going to be two nations born of this one large colony, okay? So I want you to see what these two nations look like. So in the middle is India. Let's just forget about Hyderabad being fuchsia right now. And then West and East Pakistan, divided by how many thousands of miles? Of Indian territory. And already in 1947, there was the enmity between the newly created nations of India and Pakistan. They were already enemies at that point. So the two wings, and that's what they were called, wings of Pakistan, are separated by thousands of miles of enemy territory. Okay, so just conceptualizing that already makes you think, wow, that's a project. There are other things going on as these two new nations are trying to establish themselves. So there was a kind of logic operating in making a West and an East Pakistan. I've already alluded to it. That logic was basically the Muslim majority areas, okay? So that was the League's argument. We need to keep the places where there are the most Muslims together. So there is a reason why there's a West and an East, at least there was a West and an East Pakistan in 1947. But then there's also an illogic to it. And right from the beginning of Anand's novel, in the section that's dated 1959, we get a hint of what that illogic is when Fez and Parveen are trying to take Rahana's kids. Right? They cannot stay. They cannot stay here in Dhaka. They have to go back to Lahore with us. And there's a paragraph, I've got it written down so I can give you the page number, where I can't remember if it's Fez who says it or if it's just the narrator who says it, that Dhaka is dangerous right now. It's not the proper place to be raising children. In 1959, right? So this is what, 11 years. 12 years before Operation Searchlight, which is when, and we get that narrated late March in 1971. Already in 1959, Dhaka is not safe. Why is Dhaka not safe? Anybody have any sense? Grabbing it from the, why is Dhaka not safe? Huh. It's a little late because World War II is already done. Dhaka's not safe at that time because the East Pakistanis are engaging in a whole lot of protests, right? And one of the biggest things that they were there were economic inequities operating. East Pakistan had a lot of the natural resources that were basically harvested and brought over to West Pakistan for the creation of cloth and all those sorts of things. So West Pakistan was economically dominant, and that wealth didn't flow back to the East. But at the same time, there's a language issue. And this is referred to again and again in the novel, where Rahana is sometimes embarrassed that her Urdu is rusty, and then sometimes she trots it out, right, to shame somebody into thinking or to play so that somebody doesn't think she's a sympathizer with the East Pakistanis, with the Bangladeshis, you know, so that she plays at being a West Pakistani, and she does that through using Urdu, right? But there's a section, and I think it's early on when we first meet Sabir, when Sylvie and Sabir's engagement, well, kind of engagement, is announced. And Sohel says something along the lines of, we can't even speak our own language here, by which he means that Urdu is being imposed on the East Pakistanis, who are mostly Bengali speakers, is being imposed on them as the national language. And so their language is not getting that kind of recognition, right? So these are some of the things that are happening that prove the illogic, okay, of having an East and a West wing. Most immediately, two other points I'll make before I get to this big sort of what really broke the camel's back here. The East Pakistanis were always held in a little bit of suspicion because of their close ties to Hindus and others in the Bengal region through language, through culture, through literary traditions. Okay? And so there was always this sense of, are they actually fifth columnists, right? Because they still have these strong ties to things that are not, no, that never became a part of Pakistan.
Bangladesh was once East Bengal, because Bengal was split in 1905 by the British, right?
That was that first partition that then ended up being...
that was another 1911.
Yes, kind of erased, right? Yeah, it didn't work out, it was a bad idea. There is that notion that the East Pakistanis, even the Muslims among them, were potentially fifth columnists, right? That they had stronger ties to the Hindus and to that region than they did to the idea of the concept of Pakistan, okay, and Muslim nationhood. And then the second thing that runs through. And if you caught this, if this region and this history is new to you and you caught this, my hat's off to you, there was a racialism operating too. The thought that Bengalis are smaller and darker than West Pakistanis, right? And if you notice, and I made notes of this too, in the first third of the novel, almost every time we meet a new character, the narrator tells us the shade of their skin, right? So we know, for example, that Sohel was lighter skinned, whereas Maya is darker skinned. This is really important, especially as we see the sort of maternal regard for her children, right? We understand that Mrs. Sengupta, the Hindu, whose village has always been in what became East Pakistan, she is darker, right? The Bengali workers who come and build Shona, they are black pearls. Right? All of these things are really important because they suggest a layer of racism operating too in the relationships between West and East Pakistan. So you're seeing all of these factors coming into play. So the last thing that I'll throw at you, and it's kind of combined, I think, in a lot of ways it's been collapsed. There was an election in 1970, an election across the nation of Pakistan, both East and West. Yahya, who was the military dictator at the time, said that election, unlike the others preceding it, would be one person, one vote. Okay? This is tremendous. One person, one vote. Higher population here than here. And so Mujib, who we get introduced to, who is a real figure, real historical figure, his party wins. They get the most votes. And so, by the system, he should be the head of the government. And this is what pushes it all, right? They won't form the government. They won't recognize Mujib as the leader, right? And so this is when it all starts falling apart. A cyclone hits in late 1970, hits here in the Bay of Bengal. And so there's just catastrophe. If you look it up, the 1970 cyclone, you'll know it's like the worst one on record. And there was by many accounts, absolutely no relief coming from the West. Right? So these two things happen, this natural disaster and this political disaster. And this sets the ground for Operation Searchlight in March of 1971. Okay? So those are all the sorts of things, historical things, that I wanted to lay out for you. Towards the end, as we get in the novel, it's late November, December of 1971. India formally intervenes. I mean, I think it's pretty clear, I think most historians agree, that India was probably involved the whole time. But India, you know, sort of formally says, and we're done. And they get involved, and within 3 weeks, it's all cleaned up. It's very interesting when you start looking into the official accounts of 1971. Instead of calling it a civil war, it's logged as yet another war with India, right? And I find that really interesting. So India's formal intervention in this war, in this civil war, perpetuates a particular narrative about the animosity between these two nations. Just a little sort of anecdote. When I was researching, Deborah mentioned I wrote a book on fictional representations of this war from the West Pakistani side. And I was having dinner with some Pakistani friends of mine when I was living in North Carolina, and they had some other friends over, some other Pakistanis over, and the gentleman of these visitors said, "And so what are you working on?" And I said, "So, yeah, I'm writing this book on the 1971 war from you know, the West Pakistani perspective." And he just went, I mean, and I'm sitting there thinking, "Oh my God, oh, I've totally offended him." And my friends have a son who at the time was, I think, like 14, and he's like kicking me under the table. He's like, "Oh, it's okay, don't get worked up." And this gentleman said, "You know, that's something that we don't talk about. So it's a good thing that you're writing about it." And I'm like, "Oh my God." I mean, I was like getting all warm, and I was really, really worked up about it, because I thought, yeah, you know, here's this man, this is a nice, friendly setting, and I've offended him. So I think talking about, and so Anand's novel is outside of the project that I worked on, but thinking about this time in history is really significant in the South Asian context. After the Indians intervene, the war ends December 16th, 1971. There's the surrender, okay? The Indians hold 90,000 West Pakistani prisoners of war for 2 years after that surrender. So those Pakistani POWs aren't repatriated in the West until 1974. Okay. In the meantime, in 1972, Zia Bhutto empanels a commission of judges to study what happened. So these three judges, it was the Hamidur Rahman Commission, they interview all of these people, and they look at all of these accounts. And then when the POWs are released, they talk to as many of the officers and the soldiers as they possibly can, and they write up this report. And it's a fascinating report, you know, and it does pretty much say, hey, what were we doing? You know, we have a lot of culpability for what went on over there. Bhutto classified this report, and its edition, which came after the POWs were released, and it remained classified until the year 2000, when somehow or other it got leaked to the equivalent of Time magazine in India. And so as this periodical in India is publishing parts of it, the Pakistani government's just like, and here it is, go ahead and read it, right? And so I was at McGill at the time working on this book at the Institute of Islamic Studies, and they had this in their special collection, and I nearly fell over. Like, oh my gosh, this is the greatest thing ever. And I basically read it like a novel. You know, because you've got your characters the same, many of the same, you know, the Butcher of Bengal, all of that kind of stuff showing up in here. And really that's what my book does, is it reads this and then reads all these fictional portrayals and says, you know, how are the fictional narratives helping us understand the historical, the fictional? What is the relationship between the two? I just will close by giving you a couple of points about Anam. So Golden Age was her first book. She's a young woman. I mean, I think she's, what, 43 this year. She was born in 1975. A Golden Age from 2008, her first novel. It's the first of a trilogy, the Bengal trilogy. The second is The Good Muslim. And this picks up the story of Sohail and Maya. This is 2012. And she's just published last year the third, which is called The Grace of Bones. And it looks like this. And it's about a character named Zubaydah, who is in the United States for a bit. And so it's not as deeply enmeshed in this history, but it is the extension of the family. Okay. Anam was educated here in the States. So while she was born in Dhaka, her family, because of her father's profession, bounced around a lot. And so she was educated quite well, in fact, in the States, did a PhD at Harvard in social anthropology, did her field work back in Bangladesh. And it was through that field work and talking to people who lived through the Civil War that she got the idea for the novel. Okay, and that's basically its origin. She now lives in London. So there's a whole diasporic element here. And her work, originally in English, she wrote this in English, which also says something about the, and I'll defer to my colleague, Asif, on this, the emergence or the strength of the English language literary tradition in Bangladeshi literature. It's not terribly strong as of yet, especially compared to a place like India and even what's coming out of Pakistan right now. So there's something to be said there for those of us who are particularly literary and care about that kind of thing. But that's really the long and short of what I wanted to say, except for this. You know how Mountbatten died?
Yeah, killed by the IRA.
Killed by the IRA.
The irony.
Isn't that something else? In 1979, he's killed by an IRA bomb.
Well, on vacation.
Seems it. But I found that real. When I learned that the first time, I'm like, huh, maybe karma exists. Maybe it does. I'll start with Mountbatten. I'll end with Mountbatten. I look forward to the conversation that comes out. Thanks for your attention.